Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
We've been, for the past few weeks, we have been at the World Mission Initiative Conference at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. And we've got our final installment from the World Mission Initiative this evening, the story of a mainline church, legacy, and new residents in a city neighborhood. So we talked last week about how do we decolonize mission? How do we get these assumptions that we, the European Americans, have all the right answers, and all we have to do is just go there and tell you what to do. And, you know, if we bring a youth group along, we can even build it for you, and you're going to like it, and it'll solve your problems, and you'll be happy. Done. Bev wipes her hands off and walks away, you know, like it's like the scene at the end of an action movie, right? We know, kind of, we have been at this long enough as Covenant to know kind of intuitively, that doesn't seem quite how mission is supposed to work. And so we talked about how do we have mission partnerships and relationships that not only internationally, but even right here where we are, how do we have those relationships that really make room for our partners to already know what they're doing and already know what they need, and what we really have is a relationship rather than just this sort of top down or from us to you arrangement. And we worked on trying to sort of pull that from the international relationship, where we kind of know that model, and we talk to ourselves about why that model is important. And what would that look like to bring that model closer to home? That's actually going to be what we're talking about this evening as well, because we all know that we want to care about the community around us, right? We want to care about West Des Moines and East West Des Moines, where John and I live, and Northwest Des Moines, where Ann and Bob and Marilyn live. So that's Des Moines and Johnston, for those of you who are keeping score at home. So we want to, have partnerships and care about the good of the community in each of these places. So our final speaker with us this evening is the Reverend Patrice Fowler Searcy. And she is Associate Pastor of Mission Ministries at East Liberty Presbyterian Church in Pittsburgh, in the East Liberty neighborhood. And she's going to tell the story of this Presbyterian congregation that's been in East Liberty since before the big transitions in the life of the neighborhood. And they decided to stay in East Liberty even while these transitions went on. So this this neighborhood was sort of to-do kind of neighborhood, big shopping crossroads and surrounded by some of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the city. And then there was a redevelopment time when they lost a lot of their housing stock, and there was a big demographic change that we characterize as white flight. The predominantly white population that lived in that neighborhood picked up and moved, presumably out to the suburbs somewhere. There was disinvestment economically in the community. And the congregation decided, this was a few decades ago, the congregation explicitly decided, okay, we're going to stay. And that means that eventually we will not be a majority white congregation. And that's okay. That is, in fact, a goal, given the change that's going on in their neighborhood. Because to stay involved in their neighborhood and rooted in their neighborhood would mean that they end up drawing folks who are not of the original demographic of the church membership. And so they went through a real discernment process about how do we engage with the neighborhood. Reverend Fowler Searcy is going to kind of walk us through the history of the neighborhood and the church's involvement specifically from about the 1960s up to today. So she's going to give us about, I believe it is about 7 or 8 minutes of history of the congregation's involvement in their neighborhood. So any questions before I hand it over to her?
Yes, I have one. I would like to have Sue and Ann and Pam particularly give us comments after this on how what the speaker says relates to what happened in Cottage Grove. And I also, by the way, wonder if, I forget the name of the neighborhood, I'm sorry, not Evergreen.
East Liberty?
East Liberty. If East Liberty was also the victim of running a freeway right through their territory, as Cottage Grove was. Just wondering.
Great question. I think I can answer that one. And you'll see, actually, she'll show us an aerial shot and then some of the changes. It does not look like it. So their neighborhood did not get cut in half by a freeway. But yeah, pay attention to how it did get hollowed out. And I love the point that you're making about that there will be some parallels that may hit close to home for the Cottage Grove folks. Okay, you should now be able to see Reverend Fowler Searcy up in the top corner, and she's going to show us some pictures as she goes along. There is more to hear from Reverend Fowler Searcy about the congregation's experience in partnership with the residents of the East Liberty neighborhood. She's going to move on from where we just stopped her. She's going to talk about a particular historic building that was rehabilitated, purchased by the church, rehabilitated, and then resold as part of their work in the neighborhood. And she also talks about the way that the neighborhood has changed through the process of this investment. And part of the change that has happened in the neighborhood is a racial and economic diversification. So you heard her talking about in the housing development, the one-third, one-third, one-third. So one-third families that are housing or income insufficient, she said, a third that are moderate income, and a third that are market. We were talking about the income breakdown in some of the newer housing that has been built, and you saw the transformation. We didn't have pictures of the housing project towers, but then the lower slung apartments that were East Liberty Gardens, that then were torn down to make way for those. Looked like more like a townhouse kind of concept. And so the shift there, part of that shift was to a third of the group had, a third of the apartments were set aside for folks who did not have enough income to pay anything like market rate. A third sounded like they were lower than market rate as a standard rent, and then a third were at the market rate. So you're creating some income diversity there by doing that. Welcome back to Marilyn and Sue as well. It was not your fault, it was our fault, but I'm glad that you're back with us.
Okay.
So So there was this intentional work to bring income diversity into what had become a low-income neighborhood. So then the question is, from the outside, that looks like what we call gentrification, where the existing population of a neighborhood is essentially economically pushed out of the neighborhood because higher income folks who, because of everything we've talked about for months now, also tend to be much more white than people of color who likely were in that neighborhood originally, say, hey, there's this kind of new, it's a little gritty, it's kind of interesting, it's got some character, let's go live there. And pretty soon all the people who were part of the fabric of the neighborhood can't afford to live there anymore. That's gentrification.
Well, it's kind of an opposite of what happened in Des Moines, where it was a high income group living around Cottage Grove. And when they put the freeway in, they took out all the Black people's homes and they all moved west. And then it became a low income area.
Right. So, that's probably what happened in East Liberty, probably about the same time with that sort of that in East Liberty, it looked like it was urban renewal, kind of clearing out some old housing stock and let's put in some, you know, put in some projects to provide housing for folks as if we didn't just bulldoze a million square feet of housing. And then and this may be going on in sort of that southeast of Drake kind of neighborhood as it is now, actually, that there's there may be now some, oh, hey, those, you know, those homes are really inexpensive and they're great, you know, these wonderful old homes, and you know, I can get that pretty inexpensively and move into this neighborhood with all this character.
Like William Byer, William Joyce.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that's a fabulous home.
That's a fabulous home, yeah.
But I'm sure they got it at half the price that it would be out in the
suburbs. In a different neighborhood, yeah. And so that's that gentrification process, yeah.
We live just south of the freeway, 10 houses south of the freeway on 35th Street. And that was a could go either way kind of neighborhood, but we got our house at a very nice price and the neighborhood has held up. And despite despite everything, it's being kept up.
Yeah. So,
but I don't doubt that the freeway and what was happening at Cottage Grove had the effect on our neighborhood too.
There was white flight.
Yeah, I bet so.
Several wealthy families that, you know, weren't going to live with Black people in their neighborhood. So when my brother went to Callanan in the 50s, there was one Black girl in the whole school. And of course, look at it now. You probably can't find many white people in the school.
I guess I better relate to my little 9-block segment because in my 9-block segment that has stayed mostly but not entirely white, which we wondered about, but yeah. We moved in with the idea that this house needed some fixing up and the neighborhood was kind of on the margin, but we'd take our chances.
So the unique thing that the East Liberty neighborhood did, and East Liberty Presbyterian Church was part of this. And again, this is covered in kind of the remainder of the video, was to sit down and meet with, they're calling them the legacy residents of the neighborhood. So the folks who were there first, and this all happened, probably 30 years ago that these conversations really took place. And really entered into a discernment process with the folks who were already stakeholders in the neighborhood. And they completed a neighborhood development plan. Actually, my neighborhood association in Des Moines is actually right now going through another new neighborhood development plan, which they, you know, they renew about every 10 years or so, it sounds like. I was just at their meeting last Thursday on this very same screen. So having the discernment time to sit down with the folks who are already there and already planted in the neighborhood and say, okay, what do we want to see happen? And one of the things that the legacy residents of the neighborhood, who were already a racially diverse group, they said, we want to actually diversify even more. We want to expand kind of the economic range of the neighborhood. And we can talk together as stakeholders about how to do that. But notice how that's different from the city of Pittsburgh sitting in their, you know, little ivory tower downtown saying, okay, we will tell you where the new high-rise housing developments need to be, or just sitting back and letting the, you know, kind of letting the pendulum swings of which neighborhoods are attractive to the market kind of swing back and forth. And so they said, as this kind of intentional diversification has played out, from the outside, it has actually looked like, wait a minute, is that neighborhood gentrifying? And the difference is that the locals, the legacy residents, are still able to stay there. They're still able to have a stake in that because of this intentional work that the Neighborhood Development Corporation and the church and some of these other sort of pillar institutions have done to say, okay, we know who matters here. We know who belongs in this neighborhood. We can work together to, you know, not fence ourselves in, but to maintain the integrity of this neighborhood. So Reverend Fowler Searcy tells us about kind of what it takes to have those relationships with one's neighborhood and the kind of whether it's your own neighborhood or another neighborhood is, again, these are the things that we already know, and it's just a matter of bringing them home. You know, we don't have answers until we really get to know the person that we're talking to, and the neighborhood that we're settled into. This is important, I think, for a lot of churches need to know this. But she said, you have to honestly discern the congregation's strengths and limitations. The congregation is not going to be able to do this all on their own, and they shouldn't, but instead partner with other entities, other groups in the neighborhood, whether they're a development corporation or other congregations also in the neighborhood, who have other strengths in knowing kind of where are we, what do we need to do, how do we do this? So the church does not have to be in the lead. And again, I think that that's just, I'm preaching now, but you know, that one of the things the church needs to do, the church, this white church tradition that we belong to, part of what we need to do is to step back a little bit and allow the other folks who already know what they're doing to actually be leaders and let us just point to, hey, this is going on and we can, you know, we bring something to this, but what we bring to this is not all the answers. You know, what we bring is the willingness to discern where God is at work and to, Patrice, again, take risks and be uncomfortable. Step into, I don't know where, you know, what we need to be in relationship here, but hey, let's do this. And again, this can also sort of, I think this can also go along with one of the insights that we had from Decolonizing Mission last week, talking about the way that maybe being in mission in our community is not you know, we adopt this neighborhood over here and we're going to go fix it. But maybe we partner with a church that's already in that neighborhood and say, hey, you know, we're feeling called into relationship here. You already are in relationship here. Maybe we are in mission together to this neighborhood. And so bringing different strengths and gifts to the table rather than feeling like this has to be our thing. So just again, as we talk about neighborhoods, I think maybe that's an important piece to hang on to. Bev.
Well, I guess my question there is to talk about colonizing thoughts, processes. We're presuming that they want to hear from us, the other church.
Right.
Is that, or is there a team that goes in and gets a feel if they want help, or if we want to be, do they want to be paired with anyone? Am I misunderstanding
I like that question. So the question is, yeah, how do we know that they, whichever they were talking about, that they want someone to come partner with them? Right. How would folks think about that question? All the rest of y'all. Go ahead, Warren.
Maybe Marilyn can help me on this. We joined the church in about 81, so I'm estimating this would have been in the mid-80s. Covenant, I don't know what the word, we didn't partner, but we supported, maybe be the word, Anawim. And the woman was a nun, Sister Neal, if I recall. And there again, the covenant wasn't taking the lead, but we were providing manpower on different cleanup, assembling playground equipment. And I'm sure Bob Johnson did some painting, both interior and exterior. But do you, Marilyn, were you our volunteer coordinator when that was going on?
Yeah.
Marilyn, you are muted. Marilyn, you are muted. You need to hit your unmute button. There you go. Take it away.
Okay. In the 80s, we partnered with Anawim, a housing development.
Yeah, that was it.
And we did, yeah, Marshalls are nodding, and I'm sure their sons were involved, as were our youth group. Yep. And we did a lot of just tearing the old apartments, you know, tearing out the insulation, whatever. And then Anawim would arrange for the actual rehabbing of the apartments. But we did the, what would you call what we did? The demolition. Is that how you do it?
There was some private demolition, Marshalls? But there was also some finishing work, if you will.
Right.
The apartments were getting closer to being restored where they could be inhabited, and it was a variety of works. But Marilyn, besides churches, when we were at those work projects, there were like maybe 35 people. They weren't all covenant people. Do you remember, were there multiple churches, or were there other, was there like a Kiwanis group and covenant helping Anawim? Do you remember?
Go ahead, Sue.
Where were these apartments? In West Des Moines, or?
They were on 6th Street in Des Moines.
Okay, because we worked at Homes of Oak Ridge. We worked, Kajro people worked there. Do you remember that, Ann? Were you part of that?
But anyway, we did a lot of, thank you, Warren, for reminding me of that. We did a lot of work with the rehab, and then we went back later and did the finishing work, painting.
I remember making some draperies.
Oh yeah, okay. Mary sewed, yeah, we contributed our gifts as best we could.
The question on the table, I think, was how did they, or how could we get involved with a thing like that without walking in and saying, we're smarter than you, we're in charge now.
Yeah, that colonial logic thing.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how that worked with Anawim. Can anybody help me with that?
Well, I think Stella came and talked to various churches in the Western suburbs about that program. And I think we were interested, and she was very interested in having community-wide support for this major rehab project. And then we even sponsored one of the families that moved into the completed projects, you know, the apartments. So yeah, there was a lot of involvement, and it was at her invitation and our interest. I think it was a mutual.
That's what I was going to ask. They came to Covenant and asked for assistance.
Partners. Yeah.
Yeah. So we received an invitation.
Yes. I like the way Marilyn.
The organization. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't help but relate this to some things I've done with the presbytery, where
if
you're not very careful, you're going to be perceived as, oh, those people from presbytery, what do they want? How can we make them go away? And it may be just an odd parallel, but I see it very clearly. If they don't want us, we ain't going to be there very long.
That is a very interesting parallel. I like that.
One last comment. Anawim, the thing that I remembered that I liked about them was, you know, some organizations put out a call for volunteers. You show up and then they're not organized. You stand around for 2 hours and nobody gives you any directions. Anawim had building people, construction, electrical, plumbing types that knew what they were doing and didn't expect us to come in with a whole lot of technical knowledge, but they could get us up and going pretty quickly depending on your age and prior experience. Helpful. That's the thing. We didn't stand around idle twiddling our thumbs. They knew what we were going to accomplish that day. We knew approximately what we'd be doing. It wasn't like we just showed up, nobody was there. That'll kill volunteerism with me about as fast as anything. Right. But they really knew their business. And I think they're still operating. I'm sure they're still operating.
They are still operating, yeah.
Yeah.
And there was no doubt that Sister Stella was in charge. She had arranged things. And she had to probably arrange for the professional people to be there as well. And when we got to the site, we would check with her to find out what she wanted us to do. It was very well organized.
And may I ask the name again of the sister that was involved?
Sister Stella Neal.
Stella Neal.
She's deceased.
Yeah. Oh, she is. Okay. Do you remember what order she might have been in? If it was down on 6th Street, I know my sister's order had a home down on 6th Street, right, like behind the hospital there. And there were like 5 of them that lived there and were working. And this was maybe 10, 15 years ago. But I was in the neighborhood and stopped to see them and stuff. And it's pretty fascinating, the neighborhood itself now.
They were located on the southwest corner of 6th Avenue and Hickman. Now, if I remember, there might have been 2 brick apartment buildings. It was kind of a complex.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's where they were. I think they were also headquartered, but they had properties other places around besides just that 6th and Hickman location.
Yeah. I think we also worked in at least one single family home.
Yes. Yes.
Interesting.
So so as Warren, as you described the amount of preparation that clearly Sister Stella and others had put in for the influx of volunteers that she or somebody else, or she and somebody else, had done a lot of work on, okay, you know, who's going to do what kinds of professional support do we need in order to keep these volunteers all in line? And all of that organizational work, that actually is a big piece of sort of practically speaking, why we need to make sure that we're invited when we go somewhere, right? Because if we just all show up and say, hey, we're here to fix the problem, but we don't know what the problem is, and either they haven't had the chance to do all that work, or they had to spend all this time doing the work of figuring out, okay, what am I going to do with all these Presbyterians so I can keep them busy and make them feel like they helped, instead of just being able to do the work themselves. So there's a, you know, it's one of those that you have, part of waiting to be invited is making sure that it's worth the while of the folks that you're going to help. So how do we earn an invitation? Getting an invitation from an organization like Anawim that does sort of already has a specific sort of ministry and mission going on, and they're a program. They've got these sort of long-term kind of sponsor relationships with families. But they've kind of done the work of getting an invitation into people's lives and into people's apartments. What would it look like for us to earn an invitation into, what kind of work would we need to do before we might be graced with an invitation into, for instance, Pam said in the chat, an inner city church that works with disadvantaged neighborhoods in Des Moines. So somebody who's already planted in their neighborhood and to come alongside and partner with them. But how would we earn that invitation? How would we, what kind of work would we need to do in order to have the relationship with a congregation somewhere that might say, hey, you know, I think we could work together and really solve some of these problems.
The neighborhood centers and Bidwell Riverside comes to mind, but there are others like it, have a pretty good handle on what is needed. Now, they're not going to have the project running, and they're not going to be the one that could plug us in with, you know, St. Swithin's Church, but they're asking them or the Boys and Girls Clubs or... there is, for example, a Northside Chamber of Commerce, the last I knew, they might have some knowledge.
Does anyone know how we got hooked up with Sister Stella? Was she just looking for churches, or did somebody?
Yes, she was, and she came to one of our adult forums. You know, our adult Sunday school, where you could learn about what needs there were in the community. And so that was how we got in contact with her. And then she invited us to, it took a while to develop the project, so that we had to figure out what our volunteers could do, what they wanted to do. And she was, it was a mutual
20 and 20
partnership.
Remember 20 and 20? 20 homes. And
mm-hmm. So a mutual just partnership, yeah.
To follow up on that, I think back to why it was successful, you know, we had a lot of parents with boys. And, yeah. And, you know, when you had a demo project, that might appeal to teenage boys as opposed to if you were doing some painting, interior painting. You were matching your volunteer interests and skills with the project. And we knew that up front. You know, there were some projects, I think you rarely see me with the paintbrush. I hate painting. But, you know, a little demolition doesn't hurt a guy once in a while. You know?
Right.
And that's what it was. We would put out the appeal. You knew what it was. Maybe even bring tools. Maybe if you had them all and you're going to be knocking lath plaster down or something, And so you didn't see the same people at every project because it depended. And we did a lot of two generation parents with children, or not children, couldn't be too
teens,
little.
Yeah.
Teen, yeah, yeah. And if they weren't into demolition, then maybe they passed on that opportunity. But they were specific on this location at this time, approximately all morning, or it may take morning and afternoon. See, the kind of detail, you know, I think I'm organized anyway, knew what we were getting into. And so it wasn't like, oh, geez, there's nothing here I want to do today. They didn't come if the task described didn't appeal to them.
Well, Marilyn and Reverend Severson had us involved in delivering food all around that area. And we had an Eagle project where we put in a gym, some type of a playground back there. And now all the people were chopping rocks, and there was a lot of involvement in that era.
Yeah.
So,
right. And then we did create the park in memory of Pete Severson.
Right.
That playground. Yeah. So I'm sure we could get, if we chose to have that kind of relationship again, I wondered about that. After Bob and I were gone to Wisconsin, we came back. I wondered if what kind of volunteer coordination there was coming from that neighborhood. And I have not explored it, but if we really wanted to develop relationships, I'm sure we could.
Another place we could go just to look for ideas would be St. John's Lutheran right downtown, because I don't know what they do, but their slogan is "In the City for Good," which sounds like what the Pittsburgh Church chose. And I also have heard that Capitol Hill Lutheran does some good stuff, but I don't know much about it, but they would know of things.
Right.
Certainly. Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. I think St. John's must have made the same choice that that East Liberty Presbyterian did, to say, you know, who drives downtown to go to a church? Right. And that change happened a while ago. That's not a new shift that they had to deal with, but they had to decide at some point, you know, this location model is not what it used to be. What are we going to do about that? And they clearly said, we're sticking around. What's the cathedral right next to them?
St. Ambrose.
St. Ambrose, made the same decision, perhaps for different reasons. I don't know, you know, I don't know what their discernment process was like, but those decisions to say, okay, we're going to stay here, even though this doesn't quite make sense. For what it's worth, from a church growth standpoint, if I were putting up a new church building, which I wouldn't do to begin with, but if I were putting up a new church building for a new Presbyterian congregation, I would not in a million years put it on 6 acres of land at 28th Street in Ashland.
Right.
Because the model for everybody will drive past our church and then they'll go to our church, that's not so much a model for for church growth these days, which does not mean that our location doesn't matter, right? So we have our location, and we've had some of those conversations, especially last January when we talked a little about okay, what's our neighborhood? And what's the church's neighborhood, but then what's Warren's neighborhood and what's Sue's neighborhood and what's Marilyn's neighborhood? They're just all in a row on my screen. So what's in our neighborhood and who are the people in our neighborhood? Where do we build those relationships? Marilyn, could you tell us just a little bit about, one of the things that Anna Wim also did was that we ended up partnered with a specific family. So we had, sounds like a sort of a, not a one-on-one relationship, but a many-on-one relationship with this family?
Yes, and that was a ministry that we with Stella Neal, we had a very positive relationship with her, and we decided, I don't know who, how it exactly developed, but it, we, it was a joint project. We, did we buy the condo in West Des Moines? We bought a condo in West Des Moines, downtown West Des Moines, and we rented it to a low-income family that was selected by Stella, that came through the homeless ministries in her area. And then they wanted a new start. And we had several families that were successful. They needed kind of an entry-level place. We were near a school, that kind of a thing. And then the idea was at some point they would move out. So it'd be a, kind of a starter home. And the model was great on paper, but boy, was it hard. It was really hard. And we ended our ministry with a family of a single mom with six kids. And it was just too, you know, we would, when she went to AA, we would take turns babysitting and doing things like that. We were heavily involved, but it was, we relied on Sister Stella for our advice, our direction. And she was in her home in the inner city. We were out here in West Des Moines, and it was too complicated. The one-on-one we decided as a committee, and the session agreed that we would sell that unit. It really was hard to bring families into West Des Moines, even though it was the older part of West Des Moines. They didn't feel comfortable.
Was that Valley Junction?
Yeah.
Yes.
At that time? Okay, because yeah. When you said downtown West Des Moines, I was trying to figure out where's that.
Yeah. There's a whole row of, you know, near the school, Phoenix School, and that area of new condos.
Gotcha.
That Phoenix School is now a bunch of apartments for artists.
Yeah, I heard that.
So we had paint the apartment before they moved in. And the day before they moved in, we went there for the last visit, and I opened up the screen door to go in. And there was about a 5-foot snake that had bored his head into a crack. And if we had not gone on that last trip, the first entrance in the home would be open the door and see this snake.
Ooh.
I grabbed him by the tail and gave him a toss across the street.
Oh, that's neighborly.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yay.
That's funny.
Boy. Wow.
So, there are pieces of that, the particularly the, you know, the amount of kind of dirt under your fingernails kind of relationship that you've got there. You know, that is a big piece of this kind of transformed sort of mission relationship. And it's hard. Like, this is this decolonized way of being in mission is much, much harder than either just, you know, I went somewhere and built a school, or you know, I parachuted into somebody's life and decided what they needed and then, you know, wiped my hands and walked away. But it means that we end up in these relationships where this may not work out, right? This relationship may not go the way that we wanted it to.
You're transplanting someone totally.
Right.
So that would be hard.
With environment and everything, I just can't imagine. But that's the colonial thinking, right? We were invited for that. Sister Stella invited.
Right.
She did invite us into that ministry. Some of the ministries with her were very successful. And we all agreed that we learned a great deal, and that is to bring families to get a new start out in a new, in a community like West Des Moines was just not, from inner city Des Moines, that wasn't going to work.
Right. And yeah. And so I would say probably the place where I would identify, even just sort of the wording, I think pointed to a colonial dynamic there that you said we're transplanting people.
Right.
Right. So anytime there's a, you know, anytime there's a transitive verb with another human being as the direct object, right?
Right.
We're transplanting people. We did this thing to them.
Yes. That we thought was going to be helpful.
Right. And maybe it was, right? This may have been helpful. And it may even have been what that family wanted, which is another, you know, that's another complicated piece of this whole thing, that if the other family says, yeah, I really want to go to West Des Moines, and you're just like, oh man, this is not going to work. Yeah.
Do you have a clue what you're getting yourself into, lady?
So there's this, you know, part of the humility of this. And I think this is, you know, this is where we are talking about this as a church, right? That there's a humility about this to say, yeah, you know, like that's not what I would have done. And maybe, you know, maybe we do, you know, be honest about that and be like, boy, I really don't think that's going to work. I will have your back if you do it. But, you know, I'm identifying this problem. Can we talk about it? You know, that can be fair with the, you know, with the kind of relationship that puts you at a round table, right? But that's right.
Well, if we were going to help a family or be involved with a family, supporting families, it's in their neighborhood. Yeah. And that's what the lesson was today.
Right. So maybe
bring them into our neighborhood.
Right. And so there could be, you know, there could be two different ways to work with families, right? But yeah, what if we bought a condo just down Sixth from where Sister Stella lived, you know, and what if, you know, what if that was a place that, you know, maybe we bought it and then sold it back to the next family, you know, and there are other ways to operate like this. But, you know, there's no simple answers to that. This is all very, very hard work. And learning how to decolonize this, yeah.
To get back to your question though, Nathan, how do we find an invitation? How do you make yourself known to that? Sorry, John, go ahead.
Well, I think this is part of your answer. From working with Highland Park Presby, which I think most or probably all of you know where that was located, in Highland Park. They tried. And one of the things that I learned there was that while they may not have had the right approach or the right people, the fact is they were not a good fit as Presbyterians, let alone white Presbyterians, for that neighborhood, because it was very working class, somewhat ethnic, very insulated. And if we're going to get an invitation somewhere, I think we have to consider whether we are a good fit.
But if people are willing, is that, I mean, if your congregation is willing to do something, does that not help with the fit?
We're talking, I think, mostly about developing an ongoing, interrelated, intertwined relationship. And Nathan, I'm pointing at Nathan here, can tell me whether I'm totally off base or whether that's what he's getting at. But Highland Park would try to do things for the neighborhood, and it just didn't work. And it wasn't because they were mean people.
Right.
Yeah, and John, I guess I should specify that this is not a question of whether we're mean people or not, but whether we're listening to the neighbors that we're serving. Yeah, go ahead, Sue.
I was wondering, John, I how I've always thought Highland Park was there, the Highland Park Presbyterian. Where'd you go? You left.
John just dropped out. He'll be back soon.
I just wondered when Highland Park actually got started. I always thought it was there, even when I was in high school.
They've been around a long time. Yeah, they were a church for probably 130 years.
Oh yeah.
And they just closed a couple of years ago.
Yeah. But I mean, what was John talking about? When did they?
Oh, there he is. He's back.
John, I was asking, well, what era were you talking about for Highland Park when you said,
oops, your microphone is off. There you go.
Unmute.
Yes, he's trying.
Unmute.
There he is.
5, 6 years ago?
5 or 6?
Yeah, that was toward the end of their existence.
Oh, okay.
That problem had been going on since Highland Park ceased to be an upper class neighborhood. That had been going on for a long time.
There it is. Yeah, as Russ said, the neighborhood changed. And if the church doesn't change along with the neighborhood, but tries to take its identity from the neighborhood still, you can't keep your identity in the neighborhood without being in real conversation with the neighborhood.
And that's the mistake that East Liberty did not make.
Right. They deliberately decided not to make that specific mistake, yeah.
So Pam just wrote us a note, those of you that aren't seeing the chats, Patty Spencer Burdett is a pastor at the Lutheran Church in Highland Park, and she's been working with the neighborhood.
The church is pretty much across the street from Highland Park Presbyterian. God. I mean, it's within a block or two of that. So right there.
That's not the old Highland Park Presbyterian, but it's
No. It's Lutheran. Yeah. She's working at the she's a Presbyterian minister working at a Lutheran church.
That I did not know.
Yeah.
Okay. So, thank you.
So yeah, it's a as Pam says, it's a very small congregation, but yeah, is working with the neighborhood. I don't know the particular dynamics of, you know, how their relationships are. The former Presbyterian building in Highland Park has been sold to a new. I don't know exactly how new they are as a congregation, but newly moved into the neighborhood, predominantly non-white congregation. And I wish them very well. They have a very large building to deal with.
By the way, as you know, purely for the sake of saying I told you so, when I was working with them, I said, your biggest problem is your building. Get rid of the blasted thing, rent a space on Sixth Avenue, sell this building to somebody who will use it. And they weren't in for that at the time.
But that's what First Christian did there on 24th and University. The congregation, which was small, moved somewhere else to another building and sold their building to Hope Ministries, I think. Yes.
Lutheran Church of Hope, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, they are relocating to a new building that, or not a new building, but a building that they have purchased and are rehabbing. Yeah. Warren, you are muted. Warren, you're muted. There you go.
I'm 99% sure that Frank and Rosalie Sekovic were members, longtime members at Highland Park before, for whatever reason, they moved to West Des Moines.
You are correct about that.
Yeah, and so you can imagine, if you had the caliber of couples as involved in church work as the Sekovics, as a nucleus at one time, I'm sure Highland Park was a very thriving church. And like I say, the Sekovics, for whatever reason, ended up in West Des Moines. But
right. I should name John and Kathy Eft as well.
Yes.
Were members of Highland Park. Yes. At one point, yeah. So, you know, that's as we talk about these dynamics, it's I think maybe that's a useful set of examples. And you know, we know, you know, several of us know you know, pieces of the history with Highland Park. Several of us know and have lived the history with Cottage Grove. When we talk about these colonial dynamics and the need to decolonize our relationship with the world around us, we're not saying that we are bad people, right? We're not saying that we have consciously chosen to have a relationship with the world around us that is characterized by this dividing wall that was in the title of the overall conference. But rather that these are dynamics that have kind of culturally and socially grown up around us. And some of these are dynamics that we were discipled into. If you either remember the conversation from a couple of weeks ago or did the optional viewing before the very first January session, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove talking about the way that the white Christian tradition that he grew up in as a Baptist, and it's not the Baptists who invented it, really taught him white supremacy and the gospel at the same time in a way that makes it really hard for him to tease the two apart. And that's not to say that he chose that, right? But rather it's a piece of what he was brought up in. And now it's his job. This is, if you know what you've been brought up in, your job becomes to learn how to be more faithful than that. You know, more faithful than the patterns that you were brought up in. And so that's the work that we get to do, you know, as we just work on these relationships with our neighbors and work on these relationships with the world around us.
Well, thinking about going forward, we need to look at the past. Warren and I have had many conversations out on the golf course about how the church has changed. We used to have twice as many people. We used to have dozens of teenagers. We used to have dozens of kids and lots of projects for them to do. Now when there's projects to do and there's volunteering to do, it's a bunch of old people who are retired who show up to break their backs doing these projects. So we've changed.
May I say that Covenant, without consciously doing so, has chosen to be who we are, but I think that Bruce is right. This isn't going to last forever. Our neighborhood has changed. Our demographic has very much changed. I'm pleased that we have some younger couples, but it's still basically an old white folks' home. And I think that you may be hitting the nail on the head that we may have to think about that long term.
So we could sort of continue a conversation sort of aiming in that direction and looking at, okay, what is the future of the church? Not now, no. We are at the end of our time for the evening, but
time's up.
But you never know, we might get kicked off again. No, I know why we got kicked off. Laura apologizes. It'll be fine.
Oh, Laura.
Sabotage.
That's right. But we could, we certainly could, kind of look at, okay, what's the future of religion in West Des Moines even, but in America in the, coming generation or two? Because you're right, the demographics of who we have been and the demographics of who we are, by themselves don't point in a promising direction for getting back to the way we used to be. Maybe the way we used to be is not where we're headed. So we could have that conversation as this group. That's a conversation that certainly the session also needs to be having and touches on from time to time, kind of depending on, as the session keeps an eye on, okay, where are we headed, and what's God calling us to And what is God calling an overwhelmingly white majority older congregation who under normal circumstances worships at a suburban street corner? What does God want with us?
In the middle of nowhere, right? I think that is a great question, not just for this church. It is every congregation you can think of, every parish you can think of. I'm talking with friends that are in my circles that are like, my kids don't go to church. They were raised differently than that, but they've chosen to take their kids to sporting events because they don't have any other time to do it. And I mean, it's the world is evolving somehow. And do you guys find that too in the people that you hang with? That
other organizations are that I belong to are decreasing in membership, like women's organizations. They don't need their organizations for social life anymore. Right. They do other things for social.
Well, they're doing many more family things.
The younger people are doing things differently. They just are different. They have different thoughts. It's not, church isn't one of them.
Warren is the business professor here, and I'm sure he could teach a class or three on how if you don't have a product that anybody wants, you're not going anywhere. And at some level, white, suburban, Presbyterian, I say that advisedly, Christianity is not a sexy product in most places. So we may have to think about who we are.
Okay, I think I know where we're going next week.
We're not, are you bringing Doris trying to find more people to come to church?
And how is John bringing in the sexy part here?
It's a term of art, but I'm looking at the business professor. He can define it.
The business professor. Ooh. Warren, that's you.
Well, go ahead, professor. Define sexy for us.
I'm a little more involved in non-religious activities in terms of the business perspective. If this group of on this screen could define what it takes to revitalize churches, we would be very well-paid consultants.
Absolutely.
But then we have to live further than 25 miles from the source so you can be considered the expert.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Although nowadays, an expert is just somebody you can only get on Zoom.
Oh, yes.
That's right.
It's also true that X means has been, and third is a drip of water under pressure.
That's right.
But just as one follow-up comment, and I think I've said this before, it seems like any organization that I'm in, I hear the same two themes over and over and over and over. Any organization, Morgan Horse Association, Kiwanis, church, retired teachers, more members, and we got to have some revenue-raising activities. It's not just church.
It is not just church. You're right.
Trying to figure out why don't they want to belong to these organizations? So it's a dynamic that somebody a lot smarter than me can probably figure it out. But it's not unique to just decreasing church membership and church involvement. It's I think Sue said that they don't seem to need the organizations and the activities that our parents were actively involved with that we were often involved with. I know I'm a social animal.
I had that discussion with somebody in Billings, Montana this afternoon.
And I'll that's have far them away. Let's have them be our expert.
Exactly. I'll have them work with you, and I'll take care of something somewhere else, because exactly what you were saying and I was saying is what's not happening with this organization that I'm talking about that isn't worth getting into. But it's exactly the same.
So
it isn't just Presbyterian churches in white suburbs in Iowa.
It most definitely is not. So the experts I'm actually going to bring in next week, because I don't know them, but I know people who do, actually asking exactly this question. We're going to hear from, I don't know, I got to find them talking, but I'll get it. We're going to hear from Casper Turkile and Angie Thurston. And they have done research very specifically on what is it that when we look at those rising generations, and they were looking at millennials back when millennials were young. Millennials are, every last millennial is a grown up now. So looking at millennials, and then there's a generation, I can't remember what label we've stuck on them.
X is
Gen X. Older. Nobody remembers Gen X existed, but there's the millennials, and then there's another even younger generation that matters demographically, you know, from a marketing perspective.
We're boomers.
So what these folks looked at is, where are millennials forming community? So where are millennials forming community? And so their topic is how we gather, present tense, how we gather.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.